On June 18, 2004, the administration delivered to Obiang what he had been seeking since Bush's inauguration, a high-level meeting to discuss, in depth, as Secretary of State Colin Powell put it, the enduring ties between the United States and Equatorial Guinea. Obiang arrived at 2 p.m. at the State Department in Foggy Bottom. He ascended a special elevator and sat down with Powell in the Secretary's outer office. The White House's Senior Director for African Affairs, Cindy Courville, joined the meeting, along with several other senior American diplomats. Obiang was thrilled. "I feel as if I am meeting with President Bush himself," he declared. Obiang tried to explain to Powell and his aides the complicated situation his country faced because of its rough neighborhood and its distinctive status as the only Spanish-speaking country in Africa. He said Equatorial Guinea had been very poor in the past, but now enjoyed the benefits of being one of the largest oil producers in Africa. He wanted to move toward democracy, he explained. He also wanted the Bush administration's help in protecting U.S. investments in oil and natural gas in his country. He pointed out that he had applied years earlier for a license to pay American trainers to increase the skills of Equatorial Guinea's national police and armed forces, but so far he had been refused. He asked Powell to reconsider. He wanted to modernize his military and security forces. He wanted MPRI, an American company, to take this mission on. Powell agreed to review the request. The secretary mentioned that he had heard about Equatorial Guinea's recent banking problems. Obiang replied that the Riggs matter was not very clear to him. He explained the history of Equatorial Guinea's deposits and dealings at the Washington Bank. He had made these banking arrangements in part because the U.S. oil companies stipulated they preferred to deposit oil payments into a U.S. bank. Obiang said he had to personally approve every payment from the Equatoguinean Treasury, and therefore he did not understand the allegations that oil payments went to him personally. The logic of the president's explanation was not obvious. All Powell could think of to say was that the United States supported Equatorial Guinea in its efforts to resolve these banking problems. The secretary added that he hoped Obiang would use his country's oil windfall to help his people, and that he would get it right and not repeat the mistakes of other African oil producers. Powell added, "We are here to be a friend and not to preach or lecture." Amos Hochstein and his colleagues at the Cassidy lobbying firm saw the failed coup and the meeting with Powell as the opportunity their client needed to break out of Washington's punishment box reserved for notorious African dictators. The American government coddled dictators in the Arab world, but authoritarians in Africa enjoyed less margin for error. The attitude of career Foreign Service officers at the State Department had long been, "This country doesn't matter," recalled one of Obiang's advisors. "It's a bunch of crooks running a dictatorship in the middle of nowhere." Hochstein approached the White House. He proposed that the National Security Council come up with a roadmap of governance changes that, if implemented by Obiang, could create conditions for an expansion of American security assistance to the Malabo regime. Cindy Courville, the deputy to the Senior Director for Africa at the National Security Council, was assigned to work on Cassidy's proposal. The Bush aides laid out steps Equatorial Guinea would have to take to win American favor: prisoner releases, followed by substantial public investments in health care and education. The State Department prepared new talking points for meetings with Obiang's ministers and representatives to outline concrete steps Equatorial Guinea could take on human rights benchmarks in order to win quick approval for the MPRI license to train the country's still notorious police and military. As you know, this license was previously granted on a very limited basis due largely to human rights concerns, talking points written 7 months after the coup attempt noted. "While we continue to have concerns, we recognize and applaud you for your leadership in making advances in this area. We are prepared to work with you and your government to reach agreement on the conditions under which we could approve the license in its entirety. The license would be subject to a series of criteria and conditions involving Equatorial Guinea's human rights performance. State had already discussed the proposal with MPRI, which had accepted it." Separately, and even more quietly, the Bush administration encouraged Obiang to develop a commercial and security partnership with Israel, whose military and internal security specialists had developed a global business out of selling advisory, training, intelligence collection, electronic surveillance, and arms supplies to small, weak regimes in difficult places. As he processed these offers and developments in the coup attempt's aftermath, Obiang made an intellectual decision that the U.S. was not involved, an advisor recalled. He needed to believe that. He was prepared by late 2004 to entrust his security to the United States and to Israel. Cassidy scheduled a meeting between Obiang and Mel Gamble of the CIA. Obiang's evolving plan was to have MPRI and Israeli forces work with his military and national police, but he also wanted to propose that the CIA train Equatorial Guinea's intelligence service to help protect against future coup attempts that might endanger American oil companies. The Bush administration, for its part, set aside its qualms. The administration approved the expanded MPRI license to provide internal security training to Obiang's regime. Gamble met Obiang at the Pierre Hotel in New York. Amos Hochstein, the Cassidy lobbyist, and an interpreter joined the meeting. "Yes, I think we can do this," Gamble told Obiang, referring to the plans to strengthen Obiang's security forces. "But you've got two issues. One is human rights. Two is, how are you going to pay for this?" Obiang answered that he understood the CIA had enough money in its budget to pay for these sorts of intelligence training programs.